This is the continuation of podcast 146 with Paul Wheaton.
I've got such limited space.
Right.
You know, I can see the appeal. I can see the appeal.
Yeah. So, okay.
I've marked off something from the section called Sowing a Fruit Forest. Fruit trees generally prefer high-quality soil. I begin by preparing the area using soil-improving plants so that my fruit trees will thrive. The role of green manure in the creation of humus is covered in soil fertility. That would be like a section of the book, I guess.
Right.
The amount of time this takes depends on the properties of the soil. The majority of acid soil on the Krabbeterhof, where spruce forests once grew, took around 2 years to improve to the point where I could grow fruit trees and other demanding plants without additional support. Green manure is not a one-off measure. It must play a continuous role in cultivation because a fertile and healthy soil is the key to success. So to me, as I'm reading that, I'm kind of thinking like, okay, this is like the beginning of where he goes, and he's got a coniferous forest and he's massaging things and building up his hugel beds and stuff like that. And it's like, that's why I'm guessing, I'm speculating that is why when you look at those videos, sometimes he'll have rows and rows and rows of hugel culture beds, and there won't be trees. And then other times there'll be rows and rows and rows of hugel culture beds, and there'll be young fruit trees. And so by reading this, I'm guessing, that the reason why we see the rows of hugel culture beds without trees is because those are newer hugel culture beds. They need to go a couple of years before you put the fruit trees in.
Right.
That's my guess.
Right.
From looking at
it. And this is very relevant to our area because, you know, everything in Florida has been cut down and reforested with rows of pine trees. And so everything is allelopathic, or however you pronounce that. So we basically have lots of soil that once specific, only specific plants will grow in.
Right. So, and it's true too. I think another thing is like, I remember, on my farm, a lot of the soil had a pH of 6.2, and it's kind of like, but we get so little rain. Why is the pH so low? And then you go and you'll find these other areas where the pH might be more like 7.5. And then it comes out to be that, like, oh, that's because, 15 years ago, this was a big coniferous forest, and then the farmer cut all the trees down, pulled out all the stumps, and, started off where the pH was probably like 5.2, and as time passed, then it started to get, more and more alkaline. So it's I think that there's a lot of, and then plus, I think when you drop those trees, and granted, Helen Attow and I argue at great length about how acidic it's going to be when you're first breaking down the bark and the wood and the branches and the needles and all of that stuff. And there's some debate about where does the acidity that comes under a tree, where does that come from? I still think that once you get a few years into a hugel culture bed, that a lot of the acidity and a lot of the allelopathic issue, a lot of the allelopathic concern, is probably mitigated and not there as much, or possibly even gone.
Well, I am growing an awful lot of things, in this ground. So it's I'm always heartened by when you see somebody talk about this section of my garden is very acidic and this section is very basic and that kind of thing, and this is in the middle. And I realize that these can all live in the same property together pretty well, especially when you are planting those transitional plants in there to kind of hold back the other plants' desire to spread their acid versus, bases and the different pH levels. So
right.
It's very interesting to see that you can actually get that to work in a smaller space. Right. But of course, he's got a lot of space. So yeah.
Yeah, and I think, for me, when we think about permaculture and we think about what is permaculture and why do we give a damn, and then earlier before we started recording, we were talking about Jack Spirko's The Survival Podcast, and what, you know, to me, when you start thinking about all the world's problems and, you know, all the concerns and the thing that you seek is safety, to me, all roads lead to permaculture homesteading.
I completely agree.
And it's like, you know, you got to have some acreage and you got to set it up the permaculture way. And so to me, it's like the idea of doing an urban permaculture is kind of like, it's like we're getting by for now.
Right.
Kind of a thing.
Well,
and I can see how people can do it.
Yeah.
But I can also, but I really, you know, for me, I kind of feel like that's not a destination.
No.
That's a path.
Well, you know, in the perfect world, you know, in your mind's eye, the idea of all your neighbors being on the same program and considering the block holistically versus segmentally, you know, then yes. But you have too much distance between the people who are like-minded to really get that done. But at the same time, we are, you know, Joel Salatin, he likes to talk about how there's, what is it, 35 million acres of suburban land that can be planted. Well, heck, man, if we even got 1% of that planted, that'd be a good start, you know. So, you know, in my head, I want to plant here, and we're looking for land, and we're going to plant there. And we have people who have farms nearby that are saying to us, hey, come out and do this stuff on our property. And we're like, sure, as soon as we can get some, you know, some resources up. But this, to me, is my training ground that I want to take it somewhere else and do amazing things. But then it's going to be a little different. But I want to know it all, you know. So, to me, I love reading about what Seth Holzer is doing, because that's what – it's drawing me further away from suburbia and closer to a more natural landscape.
I do like the idea of taking a city block, which might have like 18 homes on it, and on this contiguous city block with you know, and then saying, let's rip out all the fences, you know, because all 18 the all 18 families are like, this is going to be awesome and cool and we're into it and that's fine, and making basically a micro farm in between the houses. And but then in that case, then we're coming back to the whole thing of like, well, rather than, you know, making five grafts on one tree, so you have five varieties of apple on one tree.
Sure.
Then you'll have all five varieties as part of this kind of like this
right.
block, this urban farm.
Yeah. See, in the meantime, before you get somebody on board, like say two or three houses down on the other side of the block, to come on board with you, it's sort of the only way to get it to work right here, you know, or you have to grow two plum trees, which means you have to push something else out, which, you know, plum trees are fantastic things. I wouldn't be sad to have two plum trees, but I want to have things, you know, soap nuts. I want to have honey. I want to have you know, honey locust and black locust, and you know, I want to have all this other stuff. And I just absolutely could not have the space.
Okay, I want to talk about the shock method.
I love the shock method.
And I'm going to read a big chunk of the shock method, and I'm going to justify that because I've not read a whole bunch of other stuff. But even by reading the shock method, it's like I'm reading a chunk, which leaves out a bunch. And so to really do it right, you're going to have to buy the damn book. But okay, this is going to take me a moment. This is of course one of his stories as a child genius, and so I love these stories. And I've got the four videos where on YouTube where he talks about being a child genius. And those are just so good. They're so important. As a child, my route to school was very long and exhausting and took about 2 hours, even if I walked quickly. It was a simple cart path and went through the forest and past fields. I would find no end of interesting things there, a root or a nice pebble, and now and again a small tree which I would plant in my little garden. Shortly before the end of June, the end of school, I found a few small wild apple trees and a pile of stones on my way back home. So let's see, the wild apple trees were on a pile of stones.
Right.
I could not resist and took them back with me. Although they were a good 2 meters tall, I could simply pull them up without digging, because their roots had found little purchase on the stones. Full of joy, I carried them back home and wanted to show them to my mother before I planted them. Instead of the praise I had hoped for, she scolded me and said that it was a shame for the beautiful trees, because with fully grown leaves, they would not take root at this time of year. Despite this, I took the trees to my little garden, dug them in as well as I could, and, as always, covered the soil with leaves. I could not water them because the garden was too far away from the nearest source of water. I did not have any great hopes of the trees growing. My mother had explained to me that I was replanting the trees when it was already far too late, and they were already in full leaf. For this reason, I came upon the naive idea of removing all the leaves, because they seemed to be stopping the trees from taking root. Then they stood bare in my little garden. I went to look at them every day in the hope that I might see some sign of life. Several weeks passed until one of the trees suddenly, and to my complete surprise, produced new shoots. Once I discovered there was no stopping me, and, pulling her by the apron, I brought my mother to look at the garden. She would not believe my story, so I had to bring her, so that she could see for herself. Even she was surprised, and she asked me, "What did you do to make the trees grow? What luck!" Later on, this experience inspired me to develop my shock method. It is an emergency technique to allow badly rooted trees without root balls to be replanted, even when they are already full in leaf, in flower, or bearing fruit. All right, then he goes on about, you know, the shock method and how he's refined it and you know, how people do it and when and why and things of that nature.
So if growing a plant from seed in the Kramerhof is boot camp, this is SEAL training. He yanks them out by the roots, beats them to death, lays them out in the sun so that they can dry up and blow away, sticks them in the ground and says, "Here's a little mulch. Live.
Yeah.
Live.
Good luck.
Live. Hoorah."
Yeah. And so basically whatever carbohydrate they've got stored up inside of them is what's going to be needed in order to get those roots started. And then to start, you know, finding some moisture and finding some nutrients and finding whatever in order to be able to, get it just the barest beginning of a start.
He's forcing all the energy back into the center, you know, into the roots, right into the center of the plant, giving it an environment in which to grow in, and then walks away and says, "Hey, do what you can do." And I would have a hard time believing 100% of them live. I'd imagine it's not bad. But it's amazing what, you know, like if I did that, it would be dead. So I'm sitting here going, he can plant anything and it will live. It's so amazing.
Well, and of course the trick is, I think a big part of it is to pluck off the leaves.
True, which is something I've been kind of doing lately, and it really does work. You know, if you have damaged the roots at all when you pull something out or transplant or whatever, pluck off a bunch of leaves and I always mulch those in underneath the hay or whatever I'm using, and that really does seem to help. And here he's proving that is the answer.
Okay, now moving into the section processing, marketing, and selling. I've got a couple pieces marked off, which are like, you know, the most important thing out of this whole chapter, I think. All right, so first, with a large farm like the Kramerhof, where we grow approximately 14,000 fruit trees of different varieties over an area of 45 hectares, so that's about 110 acres, it would be impossible to harvest all the fruit we grow and process it. This is not only because the work required would be too extensive, but also because there are difficult-to-access areas, which make harvesting very difficult. In our case, the best use of these steep slopes is as a source of food for the pigs. So we talked about that a little bit earlier,
right?
I think.
Right.
Changing from commercial fruit growing to a permaculture system is really quite difficult. And this is so I'm bringing this part up because it seems like so many people talk. I mean, they use this phrase, which seems to be an oxymoron, a permaculture orchard. And it's like or they talk about like I'm buying this piece of property and it already has this amazing orchard, and I kind of think like it just seems like a hard decision to make when you have like you buy this property and they're like, what if it has like this 10-acre orchard already there,
right?
Then what do you do? I mean, like, do you just try to put a good rich polyculture under the orchard? Or do you actually go out and take out like 3/4 of the trees so that way you can move away from the monocrop of apples towards something more of a polyculture? I mean, I think that's a little bit of a dilemma there.
Well, you know, like if you walked into a piece of land that had a bunch of trees on it, like in my case, pine trees, you would, you know, my thought is I would go out and I would take a few out here and there and try to rejuvenate, because you know in Florida you have to have shade, because when the sun comes out it just kills everything. So you would have to slowly take out a few trees. Well, it would be a good problem to have. You've got trees that might give you fruit. Maybe tend it like a conventional orchard for a while, and then pop out a couple of trees here and there. Plant things from seed, you know, redo the polyculture underneath the canopy. And then while you have that sunlight coming into that area, grow something up and then pop out a few more. And then slowly, under a schedule, turn it into a permaculture system. I think that would work really well. I mean, you know, yeah, you'd be running it like a conventional for a while, and you would have to be backing off fertilizers and pesticides and things. I suppose there would be a way to do that slowly. It would be better than starting with a load of pine trees, in my opinion. So.
You're right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. Usually, commercial orchards are grafted on dwarf rootstocks and tied to espaliers. These dwarf rootstocks do not develop primary roots because they no longer require them for support. A naturally growing tree on a seedling rootstock, which is not supported by a stake, naturally develops strong primary roots. It braces itself against the wind and develops into an independent tree that requires no further maintenance. In the espalier gardens of commercial fruit growing, it is a good idea to make use of pigs. And this is something where I think most orchards, they don't.
Right.
But, you know, this means that you can leave all of the trees standing. They should no longer be fertilized or sprayed with pesticides, and the yield should be used as a natural source of food for the pigs. For larger livestock like cattle and horses, this is not advisable because the many wires and narrow paths would present too many hazards. If the wires and stakes were removed, however, the orchard would be left in a sorry state. In this case, you must decide if you want to make a low-quality product, which for the most part will not be profitable. Changing to a permaculture system is not only difficult because of addicted trees, but freeing yourself of the mindset of commercial fruit growing also requires you to radically change the way you think. And now for the most important paragraph.
Yeah.
And it is a single paragraph for the most, what I believe to be the most important paragraph of this entire chapter. And it's as if, It's as if this paragraph represents that entire movie, Broken Limbs, and it's that
right.
It's that movie about
the apple trees.
Yeah, the orchards of Central Washington, which is Washington is also considered the apple state. Washington State apples are like the best apples,
right?
And so, whilst I was providing a consultation on changing a farm over to using permaculture techniques in South Tyrol, an elderly farmer told me that he had been asked by the marketing cooperative to harvest his apples within a set period of time. When I replied that the apples would still be green, he explained that the apples had to be green, otherwise they would be discarded as cheap pressing apples. He was not happy with the rates. The farmer said that he had only just received the invoice for the previous year and had to pay money back because the storage costs were higher than the proceeds. I was surprised and asked him why he was still harvesting apples and delivering them. Okay, so just to be clear, I've got more to read here in this paragraph, and I'm stopping because I think what I just read is that he brought his apples to this place, they stored the apples, and then later sold them. However, they charged him for storing his own apples at their facility, and then the amount of money that they actually ended up getting for the apples was less than what they charged him for storing them. So I think what I just read is that they said, okay, you brought us, I'm just going to make up a number. You brought us 50 tons of apples. And now that they're all sold, here's the deal. You owe us $10,000.
Yeah, right.
And it's kind of like, wow, you know what? If he'd have just not screwed around those guys, and if he just sold a single box of apples for 10 bucks, he would be dollars ahead. And if he ran pigs, he probably don't. But it's like, that's the other thing, too, is not only, here's the bill for $10,000. You brought all these apples to us. It's like, that does not cover the cost of you getting the apples to us. So you had to pay for that, too. You had to pay to get all the apples harvested and brought to us. And then you had to pay for the land, and you had to pay for all the equipment, and you had to pay for all kinds of stuff in order to grow the apples. You had to pay. And you got no money for them. You got negative money for them in the end. I think that's what I just read here, but it's not clear. But I do think that's what happens to a lot of farmers today.
That's how I took it. I mean, when you watch all the documentaries and read all the stories about the farmers that have gone out of business and all this, this is what has led them to going out of business. There's just no money in it, which pushes everybody towards the big factory farms again. You know, because the little guys can't make it because there's no subsidy to them for doing what they do.
Exactly. Exactly. And I mean, it's ridiculously complicated. So, I'm going to backtrack a little bit. He was not happy with the rates. The farmer said that he had only just received the invoice for the previous year and had to pay money back because the storage costs were higher than the proceeds. I was surprised and asked him why he was still harvesting apples and delivering them. Well, yes, he said, but maybe things will go better this year. I told him that if I were him, I would think of alternatives. No, we can't do that here. We have contracts and we can't just get out of them. Also, what would people say? Once he had admitted that he was making a loss, and all that he was left with was work and the expense of chemical fertilizers and pesticides, he said, "Well, there's nothing you can do about that. That's just the way farming is. I can't do anything about it. You should explain all that to my son." All right. That's all I'm reading out of this chapter. I'm all done with the chapter. But the thing is it's like, to me, and this kind of comes back to one of Sepp's videos, where he talks about, you know, look at this area that I live in, and he's like, you know, pan the camera around, and like, okay, here's my neighbor's plot of land, and it's all these trees, and it's all these conifer trees. And so basically, what happens is that you have to pay taxes on this land for three generations, and the government requires you to plant this particular variety of conifer. And then when the time comes that you can finally harvest, the cost of getting the trees down off of the mountainside is greater than the amount that they paid the mill. So he cites this is what his neighbor did. His neighbor did the harvest the proper way, and the cost of just the cost of getting them down off the hill. Forget about the costs of all the permits and the costs of all the other things that go on. Just the cost of getting them down off of the hill is greater than the amount that they pay at the mill. So in which case it seems like, you know, if you'd put it into hugelkultur beds, all of it into hugelkultur beds, you would be way ahead of the game just by keeping the trees on your land.
But, well, you know, with every one of these stories, they're paying to farm. So if you stop farming, you're making money.
That's true. That's true. If you sit around and don't farm at all, you actually end up dollars ahead.
Exactly. I don't understand how they can continue to pay. Where are they getting that money, you know? They say one of the statistics in the United States alone, much less India, is that the reason that farmers are dying now is up 400% is suicide. And you look at this and you think, wow, I'm in a contract I can't get out of, and I can't make any money. And I don't have, like the one guy, what would people think? I don't have the guts to do something new.
Right, right. And this kind of comes back to that podcast that we did a long time ago about that weird show Thrive, where it's kind of like, and when the guy says, what will people think? It's kind of like... It's weird how we're conditioned. I mean, so many people are like conditioned to get along. Getting along is the most important thing. Being nice to other people and avoiding awkward situations is the most important thing. And so the people that are going to tell you, you know, that you know, you have to do it this way, it's like, it's not going to even be the bad guys. It's not even going to be these corporations and whatnot that are the bad corporations, the wicked people, the wicked corporations, the wickedness. It's going to be your mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and children and cousins and neighbors. All the people of your community are the people that are going to point at you and say, comply.
Right.
You know,
right.
And it's like, you know, do the normal thing. Don't be going off and doing all this crazy permaculture stuff. Do the normal thing.
Right.
It's what we all expect of you. And then it's like the whole thing we were talking about the last podcast where it's like the tears.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And it's like and for all of these cases where the argument presented to me was tears, it's kind of like, you know, I found myself in this crazy position of doing crazy things that you know, do not benefit the company, but yet, you know, I believed somebody else, and I kind of staked my stuff on it, and I agreed to go along with it, or whatever, and now, you know, it's something, they're attempting to do something that's very contrary to the goals of the organization. And it's like, you know, one time it was like, we bought this $100,000 computer, and it's like, okay, we need to do this ping every 2 seconds. We want to be able to find out if the computer is at any time not responding to a simple ping. And the woman was basically saying that if you ping it every 2 seconds, that'll bring the computer to its knees. It won't be able to do any other processing. And so, you know, my thing is it's like, if the computer cannot handle something like that every 2 seconds, and this is a computer which, you know, its marketing material says it should be able to handle like 1,000 of those every second. If the computer is not able to handle one of these every 2 seconds, then we need to return the computer.
Right. Right.
You know, we need to get something else that can actually handle it. And then, you know, so she's advocating that we not ask the computer every 2 seconds, hey, can you simply respond to this ping? Can you just say, I'm here? That's all it is. It's a ping. It's to say, hi, are you there? Yes, I'm here. That's all it does. And then we have another computer doing that so that if it ever doesn't respond within a certain amount of time, then we can, like, notify the people that we have a problem with this computer. This computer has gone into sad mode.
Right.
You know, and now we've notified these people within 2 seconds.
And know, how long ago was this?
This is 2004.
Oh, yeah. Very, very recent.
Yeah. So this is for the ground systems for the spacecraft that takes the pictures for Google Earth and the Google Maps satellite photography stuff?
Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody had a supercomputer on their desk in 2004.
Well, this is a $100,000 computer.
So it must be a whole lot better.
This is a great big machine. This is a Sun Microsystems, big beefy box.
Right, right.
And it's kind of like this is a giant computer, and it's kind of like and plus on top of that, we had the core ground systems was like 14 different really big machines, and so what we wanted to do is have this other computer that would go through all 14 once every 2 seconds and say, "Hey, you there?" And then they should all say yes.
Right.
And so then basically what the woman was saying is like, and so basically somebody else said, "Don't let that Paul Wheaton guy push you around." and he's going to ask her this, and you just tell him, "No, it can't handle that load." And so she's caught in the middle.
Right.
And my job is that I'm like talking to 80 different engineers, and we got to get everything to work together, and this is a requirement. And basically the thing is like, we have a piece of computer equipment that can't do this, then we need to get a piece of computer equipment that can do this, because we have to have it do this.
Right.
And it's like, so basically what I want to do is I want to find out from this woman is that we need to do this, and she's already told me that it can't do this. And it's like, okay, I need to find out who's telling you to do this, and I need to go talk to them. But she won't say that. She's just saying that it's physically impossible. And yet, and she's trying to not reveal whoever told this to her. And it's like, okay, it's fine. You want to reveal to me who told you? That's fine. That means you're going to make the stand on this thing. And I'm going to tell you. So here's the deal: is that if this computer won't do it, we're gonna give it. So then tears, and it's like tears don't cut it. But all right, so coming back to this thing with this guy with his apples, it's like he's been told you need to bring me apples, and you need to agree to pay for how long the apples are stored, and then you have no idea how much you're going to get per pound for these apples until after I've sold them. And I'll try to get free the best pound that I can. And that's just the way the system is. And he's like, okay.
Well, yeah, they sign into a system. It sounds like a great idea at first. And then it always goes bad. Like, this is like you're making a movie. Hey, I made the movie, and I'm going to get this little bit. After all the expenses are paid, I'm going to get this percentage. And that never happens.
And this is the problem. And so, this is the problem at Digital Globe and so many different organizations that I went to work for, is that there were people with the tears, and then people were like, oh, my need to comfort this person is greater. Like, granted, it is my job. I'm being paid a professional wage to make all these systems work. But then they would have this human need to be nice. That would be greater than the need to make the system work, even though they're being paid a professional wage and this is their job to get it done. And then that's how I would end up getting hired at these organizations, is because I wouldn't do that. I'm defective that way, I suppose.
Right.
And so then when they would come to me with the tears, or they would come to me with this, I think the number one problem in most software engineering organizations is what I called design by resume. And what it is that they want to have this certain thing on their resume, therefore that would get into whatever design they're making. And so then it's like you show up and it's like, this is inappropriate. And it's like, no, we had to do it. Why? We just had to. And they had all their stuff, and they got all defensive, and they got all angry, and I would just wait them out and then be like, "And I heard everything you said, and yet you never once gave me a reason why to use this stuff instead of just doing it by hand. If you did it by hand, it would have taken you 100 times less work, and yet you've integrated this whole other thing in here, and it really didn't do anything."
Right.
And it's like, well, the reason why they put it in there is because they wanted to put it on their resume and get a job somewhere else. So basically they had the company paying them to add this thing in, which really didn't add any value, but now they can put it on their resume.
Right.
Anyway, it's a similar kind of thing. I mean, there's like 100 different things that people would do that were not appropriate to the mission. And you'll notice that those satellite pictures are coming down. They are getting stored. They are being used. And for 5-6 years now, we've been basking in the glow of this satellite photography. Whereas, you know, for so many organizations, if I weren't there, they probably still would have gotten it done okay. But this was the thing that I went through day after day after day, where these challenges of like the woman crying, much like this guy with the apples. And he doesn't see another way of doing it because he didn't have a guy like Sepp Holzer to step in and say, and either be his advocate or help him get things onto a better track where he would actually come out dollars ahead.
Right.
You know, the guy is trusting because his human need is to trust.
Well, when you think about it, there's probably a personality type that says, you know, when you want to become a farmer, you probably want to get away from people. So you're probably not thinking contracts and business. You might be thinking business, but you're thinking somebody's going to take care of that. I'm just going to grow some food and it's going to be awesome. And then you get into the real business world and then everybody in the world's trying to like figure out how to not pay you. And then you're thinking, yeah. Wait a minute. I should have been thinking from the start, like Sepp Holzer, how am I going to get paid the best? And I need to be a business person first. So if you don't go into it with – this is why all those contracts are everywhere. And if you're not reading that contract and you're not putting your own stuff into it, you are losing out. You know, you're going to sign that contract, and I promise you there's something in there that says, oh, and by the way, you don't get paid.
Right. We've come up with a way. You've signed up for the contract. You are now contractually obligated to do this.
Right. And your whole thing is I can't wait to get out there in those fields and start soaking in the sunlight and growing food.
And it kind of seems like that's kind of part of the right. You want, I mean, this is your passion in life is to be a farmer,
mm-hmm.
but your passion in life is not to like be a salesman.
Right. Well, you know, it's similar as an artist, by the way, just so you know.
I agree. And
you have to backtrack and become a business person, sort of after the fact, after you've been in the trenches and you've gotten like almost nothing out of it.
Well, and I think that there's a lot to be said that there are going to be some artists that are going to be graphic. I mean, my impression is that if you work as a graphic artist, that it takes so much out of you to be, and it's like there's most, I would imagine that 90-95% of graphic artists go out there and they just pour their heart and soul into their work every day. They crank out a lot of stuff every day, and their take-home pay is just a little bit above minimum wage.
Sure.
Okay, that's 95% of the graphic artists out there. And then you've got your fine art folks, which go out there and they work a similar path, and they earn each year less than minimum wage.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, with fine art, it ranges from zero to, you know, decent money, but yes.
And then you've got, like, these very few people working the fine art world, and they're pulling in six figures.
Right.
And then you've got an even tinier set that are pulling in seven figures.
Right. Well,
as you explore the industry, then the idea is like, how do I find this path where I'm making six or seven figures? And that's hard. That's like you got to really kind of wrap your head around. You got to be an artist, and you got to be a little bit of a salesperson, or at least hire in a salesperson.
Well, an artist and a farmer, and there's a bunch of other industries that work this way. The actual finesse, the talent, the thing that makes it happen becomes a commodity, and the people who make all the money are the people who learn how to pull the strings and don't know anything about what you're doing. But they're pulling the strings, and they're making all the money. This is the Monsantos of the world. You know, they're saying, no matter what happens, when a seed goes in the ground, whether it grows or not, I get money.
Well, I think the Monsantos of the world are going to be like, in the artist world, are going to be like the people who sell paint. Maybe. I mean, I don't know.
Or own the industry where the art is done.
True.
Yeah,
in which case, maybe it's going to be like Disney.
Right.
You know, that would be because they're going to consume artists.
Right.
And they're going to say, you know, but we're going to pay you shit. And but I mean, like, it's with ag, it's even worse, because you're right. There's always going to be these contract growers, whether they're growing chickens or they're growing apples or whatever, and it's going to be like, okay, as part of the contract, you got to be totally signed up for the Monsanto package. And as part of the contract, you got to agree to do this and this and this and this, and you got to provide us this much stuff, and then we're going, you have to, you know, get your product warehousing, you have to pay for it over here, and then, you know, cross your fingers, hope for the best, and we'll see how much money you get.
Right.
You take all the risk, we take all the money.
Right.
Okay?
Right. And when you don't make money, we'll just have the government pay you.
Well, and that's something that sometimes gets arranged too, right?
Yeah.
You know, and it's
to keep you going.
So like,
yeah, as long as you're growing these crops and you're doing this stuff, then you'll get this little paycheck that lets you go to the next season and be a slave.
So it seems like, okay. So basically, what I'm trying to say is that it's a rough and tumble world out there. And there's it's like you've got to have at some point there's somebody that's got to be able to see all the way through all the way through and get everything to work out despite all the wonkiness and craziness.
Mm-hmm.
And even though for a lot of people all they want to do what they really want to do is they want to trust other people. And so when they got the Monsanto or they got, you know, what's the big grain buyer?
ConAgra,
yeah. They've got ConAgra and they've got these other organizations. What they want to do is they just want to trust them and do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they want to focus on farming and these other guys can focus on the warehousing and focus on these other things. But what they don't realize is that those systems have been optimized in such a way to make things better for themselves, and yet they've got a bunch of farmers that are too trusting of them.
Right.
And they take advantage of it. I think in the world of art, there is some similar stuff like that. But at the same time, there's also a lot of places where artists will work very, very hard, make like something around minimum wage, and then the organization that they work for doesn't make shit either. You know, and so basically everybody from top to bottom is getting screwed equally, and that's okay.
Well, I would
and
say
there's other.
I would say it's just like anything else, though. I mean, look at what Seth Holzer's doing. He's found a niche. He's figured out what he can do as a farmer, grow beyond amazing food, and make money with it. So as an artist, you can do the same thing. So like I used to teach art in school, and my main message to them was, you must be a business person now. Now, before you go out to be an artist, because the minute you get out there, the minute you get on your farm, there's already somebody trying to say, oh, there's a little engine that I can take power from. All I need to do is sap that energy out of that and then grab another one and grab another one. And so they create systems and programs and things like that get you sucked in, and then you're just running on a treadmill making the money. So you've got to figure out how to get off the treadmill, and this is what Sepp Holzer's doing. This is what I think the whole permaculture movement is. We're getting off the treadmill, and we are getting ourselves situated so that we are now in control of our own destinies.
So I think a lot of what we're seeing is like these big organizations that have set themselves up in a way to screw people in order to make money. That and part of their strategy is like, you know what, if we channel this many million dollars into lobbyists and campaign funds, then we can crush the permaculture people out of the picture, thus improving our own bottom lines.
You know they're talking about it.
You know, that's my thinking. That's my guess.
We're not on the radar yet, but they're still saying, you know, this is something happening here.
And so, frankly, a lot of my thinking is like, you know, if I go and get land – and I start doing this, all the things that I want to do, part of me is kind of thinking like, I need to set money aside for lawyers and for the legal defense fund thing, the farm to table legal defense fund thing, and I need to, like, you know, cover my bases in this space because I'm going to be a primary target.
Right.
And it's kind of like, I need to kind of like get my shit together in that space. Like, so there's going to be the cost of just making the leap onto the land and the costs with that and the costs of everything getting started. And it's like the amount of money that I have, I'm like not ready yet for that leap.
Right.
And so before we started recording today's podcast, I mean, we were talking about like my getting land, and it's like, you know, and I admit that I'm nervous about making this leap because of these podcasts, because of my videos, I've kind of put myself out there a little too much.
Right.
I already know that I'm collecting, I'm getting a bunch of the corporate troll stuff, this hate directed at me, which I don't think is so much hate as much as people are being paid. And I believe this now, and I know it sounds conspiracy theory-ish, but you know, you think about it, it's not really that much of a conspiracy theory. It's cheap for a company to hire a bunch of people who just spend time going around and finding the permaculture people and online saying, this is stupid. Where's the proof? Or, you know, where's the science?
Oh, right.
You know, or whatever. All the negative Nellyism. I mean, they get a big ROI on that.
Well, when you think about, okay, so you're trying to promote your website with SEO and you go find a company out of, you know, India, per se, and you say, all right, guys, just spend every waking hour, it's so cheap, just going everywhere and putting in a link from, you know, any place to my website so that I can get all that refer back information, you know, I can get all that energy directed at my website. It's just as simple to say, and I also want you to go out and find these categories because we found these categories to be anything that could possibly compete with our business and throw these messages out. It's nothing but marketing, and people are willing to do it, and they're happy to do it for a little bit of cash. It's totally not a conspiracy theory. I am sure it's happening.
Right. I think that there are places in the world where it's like, you know, we will pay you $15 a day to do this list of things. And $15 a day is so much more than $2 a day.
Yeah,
so they're making huge wealth doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And the money is so good for them that there's competition among people for these jobs. So, all right, so there is that whole thing. And so, yes, looking at this, I mean, basically ConAgra and the like are making serious bank from farmers who are signed up for their system, and it's like every year, year after year, ka-ching, 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 ka-ching. No matter whether the market is great or the market sucks, they still make awesome bank. And the farmers are like struggling to try and figure out how they can improve their income within this system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, and now here comes Sepp Holzer with his book saying, no. Ditch that system. Why are you screwed? I mean, look at this. You're getting screwed year after year after year. On the other hand, if you could just come up with a few clients, like even the people in your neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
to buy food at your Honor System farm store right here, I mean, you'll actually make money. And you'll work. And so Sepp's like got this whole thing of like, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to cut your expenses by 95%. And I'm going to increase your profits by a factor of 20. And that's just in the first couple of years.
Or I'm going to get you a profit. I mean, anything. I mean, it's real easy to start making a profit.
Yeah.
You're paying them to farm right now. Just quit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, you know, you think this message isn't going to, like, freak out the icky companies,
okay.
the big wicked companies. And I think that's a big such an important, I wish we had a word for it. I mean, I was talking to somebody who is this great person the other day, and they were like down on companies, and it's kind of like, well, wait a minute, the stuff that you're doing, isn't it a company? Well, that's different. Well, then you just said down on companies. Let's clean up our own language. Let's be down on bad guys.
Right,
you know,
right.
That's really, you know, and let's, you know, granted, the bad guys come in a lot of different flavors, but like let's be kind of working this out. People so often are like, oh, I hate Walmart, and it's kind of like, oh, so like, where do you go to spend your money? Oh, I spend it at Target, and it's like, you think Target's better than Walmart?
Right. I mean, right. No, I mean, 100%.
Same.
What was it? I don't know why his name's escaping me. The guy that wrote Omnivore's Dilemma.
Pollen.
Yeah, Michael Pollan. Thank you. Gosh. Michael Pollan, his thing, Vote With Your Fork. I mean, honestly, the whole thing is occupy yourself. You know, the whole occupying everything. You drove there. You you ate ConAgra food while you were sitting there occupying something. You were paying the banks at every move you made. You have to know how to change what you do in your daily life to take yourself off that system. Otherwise, you're feeding the monster and you're hating the monster.
Right, you are the monster.
You are the monster. So who is the bad guy?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
The bad guy is the person who can't think through that message and say, "Okay, I got to stop being the bad guy now and I got to go to that local, you know, what was the term you used? I love it. It's extreme local. I got to go to that local fruit stand and I have to buy everything I possibly can buy from them and I've got to encourage that to get bigger."
You know, I think rather than like saying I'm going to do the 100-mile diet, I think the thing to do is to say, you know what, I would like to get 20% of my diet or 30% of my diet to be within 1 mile. Can I do that?
Yeah.
How much food can I eat that comes from within 1 mile of where I live?
Right.
And that when I get that food, that it'll be zero petroleum food.
Yes.
So I won't even drive there to get it. I'll ride my bike there to get it.
Or walk.
Or you know, here's something that I think should qualify for a 1 mile diet, is that if you're currently working a job where you commute, that you're picking up food that's within 1 mile of your commute, like it was grown with it, and it'll count, because it's like you didn't even ride your bike or walk to get there, but you did stop at that where that food was grown, which is on your commute route.
Right.
You know, I think these are things that are going to really make a big difference. I mean, support that honor system market. I mean, to me, that honor system market that's just sitting there and the food's out there and you put the money in the thing, supporting an honor system market, I think, is such an enormous thing.
Right.
Which would be this guy from that paragraph that I just read, and that guy who's been totally whoring himself out to the icky company. I mean, I don't really know the company or anything, but I'm going to pretend for a moment that it's an icky company.
Yeah.
And let's say he does, you know, 2% of his business through an honor system market. And 98% of his business with the Icky Company. And then after 3 years, it's like, okay, the amount of money I made through Icky Company is like break even-ish or maybe even a negative number. But the amount of money that I made through the honor system turns out to be 99% of my income for the whole orchard.
That's where I was going with. Yeah, the 2% is the 100% of your income. So slowly make the transition.
Here's an honor system apple thing that's set up right next to the orchard / permaculture farm / whatever. And it's like then the amount of petroleum that's used in that is like hovering around zero. And you just stop by and do it on your way to things and whatnot. To me, that, supporting that, is more important, is like 1,000 times more important than supporting a farmer's market, which is, you know, much more important than supporting stuff at the grocery store. And getting it from the organic grocery store is 10 times more important than getting it from Safeway.
I agree.
Or your conventional grocery store.
I agree.
So it's like, let's like, rather than saying it's a Boolean thing, you're like, because like so many people are like, okay, if you're going to be eco, you have to do this thing or you can't be eco. And I'm thinking, no, let's have a scale. Let's these things are all so squishy.
Right.
Like it's like, you know, if you just do a couple of different things, that's like suddenly your entire footprint becomes 10 times better by doing just a few simple things. But then it's like if you kind of say it's an absolute, like the 100-mile diet, it's an absolute, you're either in or you're out. It's like, no, oh, it's too much of a bitch. There's no coffee that's grown within 100 miles of here.
Right.
And so I can't do it. I'm out. It's stupid. I, you know, fuck the whole thing.
Well,
and so it's like, yeah. But if we could say it's a scale, there's layers of improvement, there's ways to be better, and it's like, you know, let's do things for the right reasons and do things for good reasons and stuff like that. Let's make things better. Then yay. All right. I'm sorry, that all came from that one paragraph.
Yeah, it's an awesome paragraph. And by the way, it starts with the word whilst. So you know it's got to be good.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Whilst.
Whilst. Oh, okay.
Good heavens, yeah. Man.
Yeah, I... Let's keep in mind that this thing was originally in German.
Yeah, true. This is a very British book. I mean, it's beautifully laid out. I mean, as an artist, I look at it and say, very clear and clever and well done. And it's very British.
I like the thing I like about it. And you know what? I think when we're done reading the book and we've gotten all the way to the end, the question to be asked is going to be, how does this book compare to Gaia's Garden?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is the original question that I was, because like I got the book, it was sent to me by Maddie Harland 6 weeks before it appeared in the United States, and so the thing I should have done is immediately read it and reviewed it and stuff like that, and I didn't, and my life is just too weird right now with all the things I'm trying to accomplish to get information out into the world, and. But the question that came up after Maddie had sent it to me is like, okay, I'm about to teach permaculture at a college level. This is Kelda.
That's awesome.
So this is all about like, okay, I'm going to be teaching a class at Bastyr, which is a world-renowned college for naturopaths.
Wow.
So your naturopathic doctors, this is one of the big colleges in the world to go and get your naturopathic doctor gobbledygook.
There's hope in the world.
And training. And so Kelda's going to be teaching a class there. And so she's like saying, okay, Gaia's Garden? Or Sepp Poulter's permaculture?
Wow, I'd say yes.
Which one is the one do you think should be the required course material? And so she's asking me, and I'm saying, I'm ashamed to say that I have not yet read Sepp Poulter's book. I've had it in my hand for months now, and I feel like I've been wasting the effort that Maddie Harland put into it to get it to me, and I feel like a clod. And I feel disrespectful to Maddie. I feel disrespectful to Sepp. I feel like I got to fix this. So it's kind of like, all right, so then that's the question we have to answer by the time we're done getting through the book. Is it, I mean, so far it has been just loaded to the gills with profound information, but it's been a different perspective from Gaia's Garden.
Yeah, let me tell you, I've read Gaia's Garden and now I'm reading this one, and both of them have me jumping out of the chair, running out saying, I've got to do this, I've got to do something, you know. So they're both very motivating. They both have totally different perspectives and totally different ways of being written. It would be so hard to determine which one. Now, I don't think Toby, from what I can remember, has any structures or buildings in his. Am I wrong?
Right. I'm trying to think. I don't remember anything about structures or buildings.
Yeah, his is very awesome. But Sepp has structures and buildings, which I kind of think rounds out the whole – because, you know, it's got to be, where do we put the living things that don't grow in the ground? You know, the things that walk around. Where do we put them? People, livestock. You know, how do we make it so that we're not plugging electricity into these buildings so that they're comfortable without all that stuff? You know?
So Gaia's Garden, so far, so we haven't finished Sepp Poulter's book, but I'm going to say that right now I would have to say that with Gaia's Garden, it's going to be more like the urban lot, small urban,
true,
up through like 2 acres, maybe. You know, the information that you get from Gaia's Garden could be used for people that have 5 or 10 acres.
Right.
But more focused on an urban to very small acreage.
Right.
Sepp Poulter's stuff is going – and then with Gaia's Garden, it's going to be more focused also on like how to feed yourself.
Yes.
And how permaculture works in – you know, it's so like so you've gone through and you've done Mel Bartholomew's square foot gardening. You've got a year or two of gardening experience. Now let's take you into permaculture.
Right.
And, you know, so that's Gaia's Garden. Sepp Poulter's book is more like feeding the masses,
right.
large acreage, how to do permaculture on large acreage or large scale kind of thing, animals, you know, hogs, cattle, stuff like that. So much larger scale, how to deal with a lot of deer, how to deal with being rural, stuff like that. Further, I'm going to say that Sepulcher stuff might be something that you would read after Gaia's Garden, because Gaia's Garden is going to take you up to a certain level, and Sepulcher is going to take you from the level of like permaculture to being the fountain of youth. You know, so like there's this whole, I mean, like so much of Toby's stuff is not dumbed down.
No.
Toby's stuff is very direct. It has a very good scientific background, mm-hmm. and a lot of really solid logic and reason. Step is going to take somebody from doing crazy, silly agricultural things up, but there's also this stuff in Sepulcher's stuff that he alludes to, which is going to be like, this is how you create the fountain of youth on your land.
Yeah.
He doesn't say that.
Oh, I understand,
it's like,
yes.
But like people go to Sep's place for the fountain of youth experience. But then people don't go to Toby's place for the fountain of youth experience.
Toby's place is preparing you to go to Mecca. But it's like you have to have both books. I couldn't say that I could tell which one was better for me. They're both part of a journey. You know,
well, so I guess if you're going to be doing smaller stuff, like urban,
yes,
Toby's book is better.
Heck yeah.
If you're going to be doing stuff that's more like homesteading, Sep stuff is better.
Well,
how about that?
Well, but you know, there are things in Toby's book that I feel like you really need to know going into Sep's book. Although maybe not. Maybe Sep would disagree. Maybe that would be a catastrophe.
I have a hard time because it's like I'm not approaching it from like, okay, I'm a gardener, and now this will be my first taste into permaculture. So which book should I read? I have a really hard time being that guy anymore.
Right, I hear you. Well, I mean, think about guilds, super guilds, and how to put those together for your climate. That's not really in Sep's book. You know what I'm saying? Sep talks about it. He's doing that, but he's doing it where he just throws a certain bunch of things underneath the tree to take care of the trees, and then he kind of walks away. He rebuilds the land, but he doesn't go too deep into it. Where in Gaia's Garden, you're really drilling down to this is how to put together something that's we know it is not Mother Nature, but it's as close to Mother Nature, and it's giving us back what we want, and it seems to work. You know, which I love that point of view. You know, it's always got to be scientific. In other words, what I believe right now may be wrong tomorrow, but I'm going to have the open mind and know that it's wrong and to move forward from there. But he's saying, this is what we know now. Try this. And Seth's doing, this is, I mean, freaking A, look what this is doing, you know. And so he is like that next step. It's sort of like the, you know, what is it, the Bruce Lee movie where you go from level to level to level, you know. So you kind of have to get this. I think you have to have Gaia's Garden.
So, okay, excellent point. And so I think the thing that we're coming to is that these books are both like super books. Now, of course, Toby wrote his book in English in 2001, and then he's updated it since then. But of course, when he wrote it, he probably never even heard of Sepulcher, but he definitely didn't see Sepulcher's book.
Right.
Sepulcher doesn't read a lick of English. Has probably never seen Toby's book or heard of Toby, and he wrote his book independently. And so each of these books are like, I think, you know, at a similar level of importance and value. However, they're each going to present different things, and then we can talk about like, well, what are the things that each one offers that the other one does not. Like, who is the audience? I do think that at this point in time, it's fair to say that if you're going to be doing things in a more urban fashion, read Gaia's Garden first.
Yes, yeah.
If you're going to be doing things from a more... if you're going to only get one, would be another way of putting it.
Right.
If you're going to only get one, then Sep's book is going to be more for your homesteader, and Gaia's Garden is going to be more for your urban permaculturalist.
Right. right. Definitely, because there's plenty in Seth Polzer's book you won't be able to do on an urban lot.
So if you're going to be gardening recreationally, Gaia's garden. If you're going to be gardening as an income or professionally, then Seth Polzer's permaculture. In which case, I believe that the answer to the question for that Kelda put to me is like, which one should I use? And it seemed to be that what she was looking for was how to make this a part of your livelihood.
Right.
Well, then I think Seth Polzer's probably comes before Gaia's garden.
And I would say if you got Seth Polzer's book and you started on that path and you were making things amazing and you had a little extra income, you should buy Toby's book because then it's going to add detail that you don't have to what you're doing.
Well, I think no matter what your path is, both books are better than just one.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. And at the same time, I'm kind of thinking that for all the permaculture books out there, I mean, these two books are at the top of the list. And I'm having a hard time figuring out which one is the one to put above the other one, just as a general rule of thumb.
Right.
With the exception of that my goals tend to be more homesteading, more, you know,
right,
large acreage. In which case, then my stuff that I would project normally for my empire would be Seth Polzer's book.
It is tough because even as an urban lot person, with the cash to buy both, I will get so much out of both.
True.
Yeah.
All right. We good?
I think so.
Anything else to add?
No, but thank you for letting me come in here and do this. This has been a lot of fun.
Well, we're going to do some more of it because, you know, Seps are coming to town, and I got to get all this done before you arrive.
Awesome. Can't wait.
All right. If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about Sep Holzer's amazing, awesome stuff, fruit trees, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.
Amen.